Hello, I am Richard Booker. I'm a haematologist in the West Midlands, England, and this is Don't Just Read the Guidelines. Don't Just Read the Guidelines is a podcast that explores ideas and research at the cutting edge of medicine, especially anything to do with blood. I aim to provide a platform to incredible people you probably haven't heard from before and share their work, ideas, and opinions. We will take you beyond the guidelines and into the research behind them. And most importantly, into the sticky world of opinion and conjecture. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform. And don't forget to leave a review, as it really helps others to find the show. If you would like to come on the podcast or know someone else who would be great, please find me on Twitter, at Richard Booker. My guest on this episode is Angie. I met Angie back in 2021 when she was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia and looked after her during her first round of chemotherapy, right at the start of the first COVID lockdown. She's an absolute inspiration. She has some incredibly insightful learning points for all us medics, nurses, anyone working in the health service. This is a really compelling listen. It's hard to listen to at times. There are some really difficult points. And if you're a patient or a relative of someone who's just been diagnosed with acute leukemia, then I don't think this is for you. The other thing to say is that this is one person's experience. Every patient is different. Every patient's experience is different. And what works for one person might not work for another. That said, listening to this conversation, I think, is a must for anyone working in hemato-oncology. Okay, welcome to Don't Just Read the Guidelines. I'm really pleased to be joined by Angie, who I actually looked after a couple of years ago when you were diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. Hi.
Hi.
So really, it's great to have you here. I know when I texted you about it, you were pretty nervous about it, and I think you only agreed to do it because it's me.
Yes.
We kind of became friends a little bit, really, didn't we? Because you were diagnosed right at the start of COVID.
Yes.
And you had a shit time. I had a new baby, and I think we kind of just bonded over both being from this wonderful town of Cannock.
Yes, we did.
Tell me about how that diagnosis came about. What symptoms did you have? Where did you go? Who did you see?
I was tired all the time, and in the morning I couldn't get up. And I used to lie in bed thinking, how can everybody else in the world get up except for me? And it wasn't just tiredness. It was just I couldn't barely move. And I thought it was menopause because I was sort of that age. I was about 48 at the time. And I went to the doctor and I asked him to give me HRT. He did a really good job and said to me, I can't give you HRT, you'll need a blood test first.
Yeah.
So I had a blood test. But the day before the blood test, I had a strange feeling in my nose. And then when I had the blood test done, I felt really hot and bothered. And then on the next day, I lost my sense of smell and taste. And then it went from there and I got COVID. So I had to go into hospital with COVID. And while I was there, they were doing bloods every day and they didn't know why my white blood count was so low.
Yeah.
And my CRP was 526. So I kept asking the question, are my bloods low because I've got COVID? Or have I got COVID because my bloods are low?
Yeah.
And they didn't know the answer because COVID was very new and nobody knew anything about it. So I went to A&E. My daughter dragged me to A&E in March 2020. And I was admitted to Stafford Hospital. The staff at Stafford Hospital didn't know anything about COVID and they were really bad with me. Really bad.
Okay.
The experience was awful. I haven't done anything about that, but it still makes me quite angry.
In what way were they?
Once they found out I got COVID, they didn't come in to me.
Okay.
They left me in a room and I was obviously really, really hot and my bed was wet and they were supposed to come and give me fluids, which they didn't do. They didn't give me any fluids. They didn't come in to me. They didn't change my bed.
Yeah.
They said they were going to bring me a chair, which they didn't do.
Yeah.
They just kind of left me there. I think the only thing they did do was give me food.
Okay.
And then the cannula was coming out and eventually the ambulance staff came to take me to Stoke Hospital about 10:30 at night. And I got off the bed and the first thing the ambulance staff said is, your cannula. And they put a bandage around my wrist to keep it in. And I had complained to the nurse because when I pressed the button, they left me like an hour before they came in. And then the nurse told me off and said that I was, you know, one of many.
Yeah.
But when I got off the bed and I was really coughing and couldn't breathe, I think I saw the nurse's face change. Okay. And I think she might have realised that she should have paid more attention.
Yeah.
I was really ill. At the time, I'd got leukaemia. And I'd got COVID.
Did you know that you had leukaemia at that point?
No.
So what did they tell you about when you... Because for those who don't know, Stafford and Stoke are the same trust. But Stafford's a very, very much a district general hospital. And tertiary services, ITU, haematology is all at Stoke, which is about 25 miles north. Mm. So what we do is we'll transfer patients between from Stafford to Stoke who need those different services. So what did they tell you about the transfer and why you were going?
They told me that Stoke was better placed to deal with the COVID situation.
Okay.
So they transferred me to the...
AMU or...?
No, infectious diseases ward. And obviously they were completely gowned up and everything. It was really, really a strange time.
Yeah.
Yeah, very strange time. And then when I was in there for 6 days and when I left there and went home, the haematologist was ringing me daily or every other day. I probably should have realised at the time why, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And they kept ringing me and then...
Saying what?
Just asking me how I was.
Okay.
And thinking back on it, it should have been a red flag that they were ringing me that often, but it didn't seem like a red flag at the time, but they constantly ring me. And every time I saw the number on the phone, I was like, oh, God, again.
Yeah.
And...
That wasn't me, by the way.
No, it wasn't you. And then eventually... The doctor said, we can't blame COVID for your blood results.
Yeah.
And she said, you'll need to have a bone marrow biopsy, which scared the holy hell out of me.
Yeah. Why did it scare you? Because of the consequence or because of the actual procedure?
The procedure. I still don't think... I realised what was going on.
Okay.
I don't think I had any idea what was going on and I was still really poorly from COVID because it was before any of the vaccinations. So I was suffering the full force of COVID with having a very low immunity.
So this was before February 2020, wasn't it? Or January?
March. Yeah.
So tell me about when you found out you had leukaemia. When was that?
I had to go to... Went to Stafford for the bone marrow biopsy, which was awful. The two doctors that did it were amazing doctors. I can't fault them, but it felt like I was the first person they'd ever done one on, so that wasn't pleasant.
Again, it wasn't me.
It wasn't you, no. It felt like that needle was poking around a bit. And then they looked at the results on slides while I was there. And then they had to be sent off to be analysed properly. And Dr. said to me, we think you've got leukemia. We've had a look in the at the slides, and it will be confirmed next week. If you have got leukemia, you'll need chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And I just cried and said, how did it come to this? Mm. How did it get, how is this possible? He was very, very kind. And on the day I had the bone marrow biopsy, I was really poorly anyway, because I was still suffering from COVID. Mm. And then a week later, I went back, and it was the other doctor that gave me the results. And because it was COVID, she sat as far away from me as she could, across the other side of the room. She was all gowned up. Me and my daughter sat, you know, together.
At least your daughter was there.
Yeah, they did allow her to come in, fortunately, because I don't know what I would have done if she wasn't there. And she took a pad and a pen, and because she's a force to be reckoned with, you know that, Richard.
Yeah.
And she wrote everything down, and we didn't understand any of it. But then months and months later, when we looked back on it, we understood what she'd written.
What do you remember of being told? Because I think most patients, you hear like three words. You hear cancer, leukemia, chemotherapy.
No, I heard it all. Because she told me I'd got... Because my daughter and my daughter's dad... My daughter's dad had Googled it. He does that. When you tell him anything, he always Googles it to find out. And they'd decided between themselves that I needed to have chronic myeloid leukemia. Yeah. That's what... they were thinking that I should have. I hadn't Googled it. I didn't know what they were talking about. And then the doctor said to me, I'd got acute myeloid leukemia. And that scared me a bit because it wasn't what my daughter and her dad had told me that I should have. And she explained that it needed to be dealt with and that I would need chemotherapy. But every sentence she said got worse.
Okay.
So she said I would need, you know, I'd got the acute myeloid leukemia and I would need chemotherapy, but I would be an inpatient and I would need to be in there for a month and I would lose my hair and I would have a Hickman line. None of that pleased me. So I sat crying. My daughter didn't, fortunately. She was writing it all down.
Do you feel like that was too much information, or do you feel like that was the best way to? Because you need to know that kind of stuff. So do you feel like? Because what I'm trying to ask is like, when I have to do this again with the next person, what do I do? Do you give all that information in one go?
I think she was in a difficult position because I think under normal circumstances she might have sat very close to me and perhaps put her hand on me or you know, been a bit softer with it, but because of COVID she was across the other side of the room, and I felt like she might have been slightly upset by it all as well. I think it was probably better to know what was coming. Because I didn't find out that I would need to go to the QE hospital in Birmingham until I was actually having my first lot of chemotherapy. And it was you that told me that. And I was like, something else, you know. This, throughout the process, there was always something else.
Yeah.
But that is unavoidable, but it's not nice. And I think that might have been too much to tell me at the beginning, maybe, you know, to listen to all of that and then be told, and by the way, you will need a stem cell transplant and you'll have to go to another hospital that's not as close.
I think luckily that's usually not known about at the time of diagnosis, because you need some of the genetic results, which take a while, which is probably why that was sort of delayed. But I know a lot of people will mention the possibility of that. And it's quite useful to hear from you that you don't feel like that would be useful at that point. So, okay.
Yeah. I think telling me everything at the beginning, all the things that I would need, you know, and that I'd lose my hair is probably the best thing to do, to just get it out there.
Do you feel like when you, like all that stuff you were told, you feel like it actually represented what became the reality?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't fault any of the care really that I had.
Yeah.
All the care was amazing. In fact, it was initially when I came out of hospital and I'd had COVID and the doctor was ringing me daily or every other day, they were like a dog with a bone. And if you've got cancer, that's kind of what you want.
Yeah.
You don't want to be left alone. But I didn't know at that stage that that's what it was.
Yeah.
But I think that's because of COVID. So that gave me a bit of a different experience to some people. But I think the thing that I would like you to take from today is that the amount of times that I was told I could die, you only need to be told that once, because it's not something you're going to forget. But constantly, every appointment I had, I was told you could die. If you have the treatment, it could kill you. If you don't have the treatment, you could die anyway. When I had my very first lot of chemo, just before I was having the first lot of chemo, the doctor came in for the consent forms and she said that, do I consent to it? And I said, yeah, but I don't want it. Obviously, I don't want it. And I was very upset by it. Mm. And she said, well, you have to weigh up the risks. She said, she said, having the chemo can give you long-term heart conditions and other problems with organs. Mm. But if you don't have it, you can die anyway. And then she left the room and then I was left. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, did I really need to know that just before I'm having my first bag of chemo? Did you need to say that? Yes. You know, possibly. And she's probably said it so many times that she's desensitized from it. The doctors need to know that you hear it every day, but we don't.
Yeah, yeah.
And every single time I went, they told me I could die.
Hmm.
And one doctor even put it in a letter, which I read once, and I'll never read that letter again.
Hmm.
But that was never going to happen.
Yeah.
I was never going to die.
And it's when you put it like that, you think, well, what's the point in telling you all that? Because, like, we all want to be honest. But if a patient does die, they're not going to sue you for not telling them enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's exactly. Not like it kind of
and
changed
also,
them.
You only need to hear it once. Yeah. You don't need to keep hearing it. And I used to dread going to the hospital because they were going to tell me again.
Yeah.
And my daughter used to ask for statistics all the time, and I didn't want those statistics. That's not something that I ever wanted to know, because I'm not everybody else. I'm not a number, and it was never an option for me to die. So I don't think statistics really help.
I know some people ask, and when I was a med student, I sat in with an oncology consultant, and the most skillful thing I've ever seen, this guy asked, or the daughter asks, how long's he got? And he said, you need to really think about whether you want to know the answer to that question. And obviously I can't answer that question in any meaningful way for you. And actually, that's how I diffuse that question now. And I'll say I'm happy to talk about statistics, but please go away and think about whether you really want to know the ins and outs of it. Yeah. Because you're right, it is relatively meaningless, isn't it? It's not going to change. If you got a 50% chance of dying versus a 70% chance of dying, you still got a high chance of dying. Mm. Like, it's not going to change your psychology, is it?
No.
Even if someone says, oh, you're 98% chance of survival, it's probably still going to be hanging in your head that there's two. I mean, probably, you know, if you had CML, for example, I would say, you know, this is a disease with a pretty normal life expectancy and, you know, we've got incredibly good treatments.
Mm.
I think if the scales are weighted so far in someone's favour, then fair enough. With AML, it's difficult, isn't it? Because certain, you know, genetic categories of AML do have such terrible prognoses that you...
But I also think that It depends on the person, because I think your mentality and your attitude can also affect your progress and the treatment, the effectiveness of the treatment.
I mean, I think so far you've just given such a wonderful description of, you know, how it feels to be in that moment. I want to ask you one question about that, and then we'll just move on. So when you're sat there and someone tells you you've got leukemia, and it's a bad leukemia, like, what goes through your head? Do you just think...
How has it come to this? What happened? What did I do? What didn't I do? And I think I asked him, you know, could I have avoided it?
Yeah. That's really interesting, because intuitively to me, I'd think, oh, if someone said that to me, I'd think, okay, well, what are we got to do next? But it's really interesting that you kind of thought, you were thinking about the cause, which is not what I would expect.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And obviously, he followed it up by saying, you'll need chemo, which I think when he said chemo,
yeah,
it affected me more than leukemia.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I knew that I was going to lose my hair.
Yeah.
Which no woman wants to lose her hair.
Yeah. Do you think some of the terminology is helpful? Like, would it be better to say blood cancer rather than leukemia? Or would it be better to say treatment rather than chemotherapy? What do you think?
No, I think it was better to... For me, it was better to tell me what it was, to be straight with me. I mean, you know, throughout the process, I always wanted my blood results. I write them down. I send them to my mum writes them down. Everybody knows what my results are. So, you know, trying to word it differently to somebody like me wouldn't have been worth it, because I would have still asked the questions.
Okay. The hair thing's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we think about that as a relatively minor consequence. But
for a lady...
Yeah.
I have heard, because obviously I'm on different forums, I have heard people say that, you know, they've been told they've got cancer and they've got young children, but the first thing they think about is the hair. And for, as a doctor, you wouldn't think that that would be a concern. Yeah. You'd be thinking about your children or your life or your health or your work. But your hair is the main thing you think about. Yeah. But I can honestly say that losing my hair was the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Go on.
Because I just got a full head of fantastic, soft, untreated hair.
Okay.
And it's far better than it was before.
It's not the sort of the hair treatment that I would recommend to general public.
No, I wouldn't recommend
it. It's quite a lot to go through, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But hey, outcome's good.
Yeah, there has to be the silver lining in the cloud, and there are some silver linings in my journey and in the treatment. There are several, and I've always stuck to those.
Let's go into that now. What are the silver linings?
I don't know how much detail you want about this.
Well, they can always edit it out.
Yeah, so. you might need to. One of the things that I had prior to the chemotherapy was I was lactose intolerant.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm not.
Okay.
Don't know why that is, but it's since my treatment and I'm not lactose intolerant. I don't know whether it's because the chemotherapy affects your stomach and, you know. Also, I suffered with piles quite badly. I had irritable bowel that was brought on by being lactose intolerant. Mm. So that was quite bad. And there were certain foods that I could not touch, like white bread, could not touch that. But now I have no problems with piles whatsoever. And I'm not lactose intolerant.
Okay. Brilliant.
So those are some of the silver linings. Yeah.
Just touch back on your hair, because it was one of the funniest things about you and our relationship.
Oh, yeah.
the Kiwi thing.
Well, I had my hair shaved off by... It was an awful moment. I went in the shower one morning and I expected my hair to come out, but I didn't expect it to come out as much as it did. And I feel like in the shower that morning, I could literally have pulled all my hair out of my scalp because I was pulling and it was just coming out in massive clumps. And I called the nursing. I was very upset. I was crying and I said, you're going to have to get it off because I can't do this every morning. You're going to have to shave it off. She, later on that day, went home and got her own hair clippers. And one of the trainee nurses, who I'm also friends with, shaved it off. And another, I think she was a trainee nurse as well, sat in front of me and talked to me while I was having it done. And actually, once it was off, I felt a lot better. Then obviously when I had the chemo, it started to drop out properly and my daughter referred to me as potato. And I remember saying to you, you know, I'm a potato. And you said more of a kiwi because they're sweeter.
Yeah, and furry.
And that's what, and you know, I think that cemented our relationship at that point.
There's a bit of a risk for me, but I always try and bring in my own sort of sense of humour.
Well, I think
we knew each other by then.
Richard came in to see me every day and gave me my blood results and he sat with me and we had a chat. That was a highlight of my day, every day that was, because we built a relationship like from the very first moment I spoke to you. And he bought me bananas. I remember that. Yeah, and he got a new baby and his wife was looking after the baby and he was telling me about cutting fruit up for his wife to make it easier. And it was just lovely to hear.
She didn't get that on the second baby, by the way.
No, but that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, awesome. Let's move on to the chemotherapy itself then, because you would have consented to chemotherapy. And I don't want to go into that in too much detail, but that first cycle of chemo, was it the hair loss that was the main sort of thing? Because I remember you kind of probably sort of sailed through that relatively well.
Yeah, I sailed through it in terms of side effects. I didn't really have many side effects from that.
Yeah.
The only side effect I really did have was from my bum.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I had an abscess.
Yeah.
So Richard did offer to look and I refused.
Yeah. Someone looked there, didn't they?
Yeah, I got a lady to look.
Yeah.
So I did consent, but like I say, when the doctor came in to bring the consent form, she lacked a little bit of empathy. And I think that may be, you know, like I say, consultants and doctors deal with it on a daily basis, but the patients don't. Mm. And when she said what she said and walked out of the room, it just left, I was in tears.
Yeah.
And when they came in to bring the first bag, the nurses were amazing. Mm. I'm friends with some of them on Facebook. But they were amazing. They were light-hearted. Mm. They didn't make me feel down or depressed. Yeah. In fact, they used to come in and we'd have a laugh, and I've got quite a naughty sense of humour and they seem to like it. Yeah. So we'd have a laugh. But the first time I had the chemo, I did sit there thinking, I don't want this.
Yeah.
And how did it come to this?
Yeah. It's interesting, again, go back to that how, isn't it? Yeah. That chemotherapy consent is an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously you've already sort of, you've been told you're going to die about 100 times. You've been told that the only sort of possibility is chemo. So why does it help? It doesn't really help you going through all the minutiae of all those side effects, or does it?
Can you rephrase that question?
So we kind of have to explain like all the tiny little possible side effects, you know, long-term effects on the heart, needing transfusions, etc., etc., and we're sort of legally bound to explain all that, but maybe it's not that helpful to you in that moment.
No, not when you're about to have that first, and you really don't want that first lot of treatment.
Yeah.
And also because it was during COVID again, I couldn't have any visitors.
Yeah.
So I'd got nobody that could be with me, and I think it might have been it might have been helpful with the first round of chemo if I'd have had somebody with me for the first bag. Although, for the rest of my treatment, I don't think I'd have wanted family to come and see me because I think it would have upset them too much.
I'm learning so much from this because you're just pointing out these sort of points in the journey which I wouldn't have even thought of being particularly stressful, you know. I mean, now you say it, it's pretty obvious that first bag of chemotherapy would be a big deal. But actually, the administration of the chemotherapy, you don't feel anything. You don't feel in that time.
No.
But it's really intriguing that you're sort of pointing that out. And I'm sure that's probably shared by lots of patients.
Yeah.
And I think anyone listening to this and me, we should be really thinking about that. And especially with inpatients, you know, can you time it so someone's there with them if they want
well,
that?
Well, I couldn't.
But you couldn't
for
that
me.
Time. Yeah.
But that first bag of chemo meant that it was real.
Yeah.
That made it real because you can be told anything, but the first bag of chemo made it real and it was poison.
Yeah.
And that was the start of, I felt at that time, it was the start of all the side effects that could have happened. But while we're on the subject of side effects, I've had everything checked since. I've had all my organs checked and I haven't got any problems with anything.
Good.
So all the side effects that could have happened haven't.
Let's talk about bone marrow transplant. So you're obviously told at one point that you would need this.
Yeah.
When you went to the QE in Birmingham for a clinic, did you physically go there? Was it virtual or you must have gone?
Yeah, I went and they showed us around and I met. And but it was another guy who sat down and spoke to me. He's since left, I think. He was okay. I think there was a bit of a lack of empathy there. It was like a daily routine and it felt like he was reading something off a script. It was scary.
Okay.
The whole thing, there was a nurse and I saw her that time when I went to the QE and she said to me and my daughter, you'll be more tired than you've ever been in your life. It'll be awful. And I said, no, I'll be fine. I'm going to smash this. No, you won't. You'll be 100 times more tired than you've ever been in your life. And then we were talking about driving and I'm not a very good passenger and I was worried about how I was going to get to the QE. And she said, well, you can't drive yourself in case you have a blackout. And then me and my daughter left the room and we were both of the same opinion. Well, she's an arse. Don't want to speak to her again. She could have... Okay, so yes, in all honesty, I still am. Very tired, it drains your energy. But did she really need to speak to me like that? She really wasn't very nice. I only saw her one other time. She came to see me in hospital in the QE after I'd had my transplant, or maybe just before. And then I didn't see her again, thankfully. But what was the blackout thing? I mean, where did that come from? That had never been mentioned before or after. And as it turned out, after 2 weeks after my transplant, I did start driving and I took myself to the QE every day. So, you know.
God, we have to be so careful what we say, you know. You can easily say something just you don't even think about it.
She wasn't very nice about it, though. You know, if you'd have said it to me, it might have come out differently. But she wasn't nice about it.
Okay.
You know, and that's not really what you want to hear. And you sympathy and empathy and kindness is what you want. And that's why me and you are friends. And I made friends with another doctor at the QE who was also very kind to me.
So how was that? How was the transplant? In a word, shit.
Awful. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely awful.
Was it what you were expecting?
No.
Worse?
Oh, yeah. The side effects were, yeah.
And how much worse was that than the chemo?
I think the chemo was bad. The first lot I sailed through, the second lot wasn't so pleasant. And the second lot actually gave me a really bad back, which is one of the side effects. And then you have chemo when you go, just before you have the transplant, you have chemo and some kind of conditioning treatment.
Yeah.
And that's really intensive because that has to kill all your cells mm-hmm. to allow for the new cells to go in. And also, the side effects are really bad. You know, the sickness, I just couldn't... They couldn't stop the sickness, the nausea. I had really bad nausea. I had really bad diarrhea. And obviously I was already suffering with my bum. So, and actually, would you believe, it was... I want to say it was a cleaner. I feel like it was the cleaner who said to me, because I was in agony with my bum, and nobody was giving me anything. You know, they were offering me Anusol, which didn't do anything. So the cleaner said, I'll go and get you some. It was like barrier cream, okay. And it was in little packets. And she went and got me a box. And the barrier cream solved the problem.
Good.
And it was a cleaner or somebody, you know, like that. And the doctors were trying to give me Anusol, which didn't do anything. And I kept telling them, it's not doing anything. And then somebody just went and got me some barrier cream that worked. But also, I think what I'd like you to take from this as well is I was telling them that I was feeling sick and I was being sick. And it was awful. Mm. And they were giving me medication and they'd got me hooked up to a McKinley driver as well. And it wasn't solving the sickness. And I was told later, at an appointment much, much later, that the tablets I was being given were for my brain.
Yeah.
For the sickness.
Yeah.
But I knew, I don't know how I knew this, but I knew it was something I needed tablets for my stomach.
Okay.
When they gave me tablets that dealt with my stomach, not my brain... So they gave me domperidone.
Yeah.
They worked.
Okay.
A treat.
So it's a good lesson that, you know, if one type of antiemetic's not working, we can switch and we can
but
add.
But I kept telling them and they kept giving me things and it wasn't working and it was going on and on and on.
Yeah.
And all they needed to do was give me a different type and they didn't.
Mm.
Throughout the whole of my stay in the QE, they didn't give me domperidone. And what they did give me didn't work.
Mm.
Obviously, just after my transplant, I also had a bleed on the brain, which there's lessons to be learned from that as well, because...
How long after the transplant?
Why you were... Maybe 2 days.
Right, okay.
After
2 days after you'd had the cells?
Yes, yeah, okay. I think. But what happened was, because I had a bleed on the brain, I can't remember everything that happened, and I still don't know to this day exactly what did happen. But my daughter couldn't get hold of me. I wasn't answering my phone. And it went on for 2 or 3 days, and they were getting a bit annoyed with me. Mm. And eventually, when I came round and I did... speak to my daughter, she was asking me questions. Why aren't you answering me? Why aren't you talking to me? I had no idea. And I was saying, well, I don't know what you mean. But the doctor didn't ring her and explain to her that what had happened. And that, you know, if you don't hear from your mom, it's because of this.
Mm.
I had to say to him, can you ring my daughter? Because I don't know what she's talking about. Has something happened? Can you... So, obviously, he did ring her and he spoke to her, but it was a bit late and they were all really worried because they hadn't heard from me and, of course, they couldn't come to the hospital.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
There's lessons there, really. Yeah. But I had very bad mucositis. It was It was awful. I'd already lost my sense of smell and taste, and then my sense of smell and taste came back, but it was everything, literally everything, smelt and tasted vile. It's the worst. I think that was possibly one of the worst side effects, and it went on for some, even now, 3 years later, I still don't like the smell of most aftershaves.
Okay.
There's something in it that smells off to me. So
seediness.
Well, whatever. Obviously, while I got mucositis and thrush in my mouth, I wasn't eating much anyway. But they were coming in and wanting me to take potassium or magnesium tablet. And they're like horse tablets.
Yeah, yeah.
They're huge. And I was being sick all the time. I felt sick. And I got, like, my mouth was raw. Yeah. It was like raw meat. And they're wanting me to take these tablets. Yeah. And they kept coming in with tablets. And in the end, I refused to take, you know me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm like.
Well, yeah.
I refused to take these huge tablets because, you know, how are you supposed to do that? I mean, can that be given into your vein?
Yeah.
It might have been that I was hooked up to too many things and couldn't get anything else in. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
often some of those things were chasing numbers. So you think, well, like a normal magnesium is supposed to be 0.7. And we'll give these kind of tablets when it's 0.6. But no one's ever done a study to show that if you treat it, people do better. So, and you never used to measure magnesium. So it's one of those that I don't really believe in. But we all still do it. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but try giving somebody, when you can see that they're feeling and being sick all the time, they've got diarrhoea and, you know, the mouth is red raw and you're giving them all these tablets to take.
Yeah.
And then they were giving me frog spawn to swirl around my mouth.
Oh, yeah, okay. What's...
I forgot what it's called. It's in little sachets and it's like clear and it's just like frog spawn.
Okay.
And it's for your mouth, for your...
Is it like Glandosane or something?
It's like... No, it wasn't that. Okay. It was... I forget what it was called.
It's funny, I probably prescribe it all the time. I have no idea what it actually is.
Possibly. But you, it would be good if you could put that in your mouth and try it yourself and see what it's like for a patient to.
Yeah.
And they were telling me to do it. And obviously, I wanted my mouth to be better and I was doing it. But it was like frog spawn. Just like frog spawn. Yeah. That's the best way to describe it. It was horrible. I did it. But it was awful and everything tasted vile and I wasn't eating. And I don't think nobody ever told me to make sure I was eating, because in all reality, if you can't eat, you're not going to eat, are you?
Yeah.
I have got weight to lose and I did lose some, but I didn't lose as much as I thought I would.
Again, not a diet I recommend.
No, definitely not. No. I mean, the after effects were horrific. The recovery was slow. It was awful. I went back to work 5 months after my treatment, which I've been told was quite quick. But I did get 10 weeks phased return, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And obviously then, after that, I got COVID again and was in ICU. So that's, I don't know if you want to touch on that.
It's another story, isn't it? Yeah, let's touch on it.
What do you want to know?
How long were you, because you were ventilated for a couple of months, weren't you?
I mean, I was in hospital 17 days. I hadn't felt very well. It was December 21.
Yeah.
I hadn't felt very well for a couple of weeks. I just didn't feel well. And I carried on working. And on Monday the 20th of December, I was supposed to work that Monday to Thursday. And on the Monday, I text my boss and I said, I'm not going to be in this week. I really don't feel well. And I don't feel like I can do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't felt well for a couple of weeks, but I'd carried on and carried on. And I felt like I might have had a chest infection. So on the Wednesday, I felt really guilty about work. And I thought, they're going to think it's just because it's Christmas and and I just don't want to work. And I thought, I also thought, they're going to think, well, how do you know you're not going to be well enough to come in the rest of the week? Mm-hmm. But I just did. So I went to the doctors on the Wednesday, and I thought it was the HRT because I just started taking it. And she said, well, you can stop until after Christmas and then start again and see how you feel. And I insisted that they did bloods there and then. I played my face and they did bloods. And at 9:15 that night, a doctor rang me and said, we need to get you to hospital now.
Right.
Your CRP is nearly 300. And then I said to her, but you're going to have to give me half an hour because I need to get a bag ready. Mm. I said, I haven't got anything. Yeah. And I can't expect my daughter to be driving to, I thought, the QE on Christmas Eve. Because this was the 23rd of December. So she said, well, I can't really tell the ambulance staff that to give you half an hour. Yeah. She said, so what I'm going to do is I'll ring my next patient and then I'll ring you back and then you've got time. So I had to get up at 11:45 and do an overnight bag for the hospital. Yeah. Obviously, my daughter woke up, so she was really worried.
Yeah.
And she caught COVID. So at this point, she got COVID as well. I didn't know how I'd got it, but she got it. And as it turned out, I didn't go to hospital that night, but I went to see my GP the next day. And he didn't do repeat bloods. He just said, if your CRP is nearly 300, I've got to admit you to hospital because if I don't, I'm not going to sleep tonight.
Yeah. Fair enough.
He was, and he is, really good.
Yeah.
And I just said, well, Merry Christmas to me then. So I went home, and eventually the ambulance staff came and got in the ambulance. And the first thing he said, well, he took my temperature, and he said, have you been taking your temperature? And I said, yeah. And he said, what was it? And I said, 36 point something. And he said, he showed me, and it was 39.
Right.
So it was lights on. Sirens going, and I was saying, but I'm fine, I'm talking to you. What, why are you doing that? They put the air, it was December, they put the air conditioning on. I had to take my coat off, I couldn't go to the QE, which is where I wanted to go, because they knew me.
Yeah.
They'd got 10 people backed up in ambulances outside, so they took me to New Cross.
Yeah. That's Wolverhampton.
Yeah. I was admitted to A&E first. They did lots of tests. And then I was admitted to a ward. And then I don't really remember a lot after that. I don't remember having a shower or changing my pyjamas, but from photos I did. I genuinely don't remember. I remember Christmas morning, they brought me a Christmas dinner in. And the nurse didn't say Merry Christmas or anything. She just came in as normal. And I said, oh, Merry Christmas. And she went, oh yeah. Yeah, so I was like, oh, okay then.
Yeah.
And then the next thing I remember, I was telling the nurse in ICU that I couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise how exhausting it is when you can't breathe. Yeah. And it was scary, really, really, really scary, and really hard work trying to breathe. Yeah. And they'd got a mask that was covering my face, which was uncomfortable and making me feel claustrophobic.
And they're all in full PPE, and you feel like we're in some kind of horror film.
Yeah. It was scary. And then the one doctor was trying to put a line in, and I think he was trying to put it in my wrist, because when I woke up, both of my wrists were black. I think he was trying to put it in it might have been my foot, I can't remember. But he tried three times. And I was thinking, I'm not a pincushion. Can somebody else, please, just don't let him keep trying.
Yeah.
It's not comfortable to do this. Can you just... Anyway, the head, the consultant came over and he was hand-fisted. Very good. He got the thing in, but, you know, it went in with some force.
Right.
He did the job, which I don't suppose you can ask for more than that. He was drop-dead gorgeous. So that kind of offset the hand-fistedness. You know, you've got to have, you know... But apparently I spoke to my daughter and I could barely breathe and I was really, really poorly. But I managed to tell her that the doctor was really gorgeous and she thought it was really funny and I think he might have heard me. So, yeah. And then I remember saying to the doctor, to the nurse, I can't do this anymore. And she said, we can put you to sleep. And I said to her, will I wake up? And she said, we can't guarantee it.
So I just don't see the point. What's, yeah. What do because you think? Is it better to say yes?
Well,
or is it better to be honest? Like,
I don't know. If you don't wake up, you're not going to know about it, are you? And then she said, do you want to ring your daughter and tell her? And firstly, I couldn't breathe. So I don't know how at that point I was going to tell my daughter. But I didn't want to tell my daughter that I'd made a decision to do something that I might not wake up from because I thought she might say, don't do it.
Yeah.
And I had no choice. So I said to the nurse, no, tell her when you've done it. And then apparently she did ring my daughter and tell her that they'd put me on a ventilator. And the nurse said to my daughter, I did tell her to ring you, but she didn't want to.
Yeah.
But that made Holly feel really bad because she said, Holly had given me, at this point, it had become clear that I'd got COVID. Now, my daughter had got COVID first. She'd given me COVID and she thought that I didn't want to speak to her because I was angry with her for giving me COVID. And if I had have died...
Yeah.
That's what she would have thought for the rest of her life.
Wow.
So that nurse's comment could have affected somebody for the rest of their life. Yeah. But that wasn't the reason. I didn't want to ring her. The reason. How do you tell the person you love the most that you've made a decision that you might not wake up from?
I don't know. You can't, can you?
I didn't want to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And I'd... probably wouldn't have been fit enough to have the conversation anyway because couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
How can you talk and tell somebody that when you can't breathe?
Yeah.
So then eventually they brought me round from the ventilator. I think it was they tried to bring me round on the 1st of January and I was too stressed and anxious, so they put me back under and brought me back out on the 2nd. And I don't think I had any idea what was going on at all. I didn't understand what had happened, and I was very anxious and I was shaking from head to toe. And they kept asking me what was wrong with me, and I was saying I'm anxious, and they were saying, why are you anxious? What sort of question is that? Why are you anxious? Because I'm in ICU. I don't know what's happening and I'm completely incapacitated. Yeah. I'm hooked up to everything. And you're asking me why I'm anxious? And they rang my daughter, apparently. Rang my mum first and said, can you talk to her? She's really anxious. We need to calm her down. Mm. And it didn't work. And then they rang my daughter, and my daughter apparently spoke to me and said, you know, everything will be okay. You are okay. You're going to come out of this. Just don't talk. Just try and relax. And apparently I fell asleep. She's always bored me. I fell asleep and the nurses said to my daughter, thank you so much. She's asleep and she's calm now.
Okay.
But the while I was in ICU, that was worse than the transplant. And the nightmares, I still have flashbacks of the nightmares I had.
Okay.
The nightmares were awful. Really, really horrible. And this is a question, I don't know if you can answer, but in my nightmares, my hands were... Something was happening to my hands and I was putting my hands on the floor. When I was in ICU and I was on a ventilator, was something happening to my hands? Were they doing... Do they have your hands hanging by the side of the bed, or what was happening to my hands that in my dream?
I wonder if it's proning. So they would have
proned
you.
Yeah.
And for that, you've probably got to, you've got to turn people over.
Yeah.
And for that, you'll be rolling over hands, maybe. I don't know. I'm not Joseph, though. I'm not Joseph from the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, so I've got no idea.
Well, I thought you knew everything, Richard.
I just give that impression. Can I, before we finish, this has been ridiculously invaluable. I want to ask you about your donor, your stem cell donor. Mm. Do you ever think about that person? And
do you know what? I think about him all the time. I know it's a man. I wrote him a letter when I had the transplant. And I told him that at this moment, I'm receiving your cells. Mm. But obviously, couldn't give any personal information because it has to be 2 years.
Okay.
And then later on, I wrote him another letter. And eventually, he replied and said that he'd had both of them. He was really sorry. He wanted to exchange personal details. Oh. But in England, you have to wait 2 years. So... On my 2 year day, I emailed again, but I think the emails are going to an account he doesn't use.
Right.
So I gave him all my personal details, but I've not heard back from him. I know that he wants to keep in contact, but I think it's possible that he hasn't read them. Hasn't read the last one. They were having a baby. Him and his wife were having the first baby, and it was a girl last June. So the baby will now be a year old. And he lives in America. Obviously, he couldn't tell. They'd crossed out the area, and he was 32 at that time. Well, similar age to you. And he was married, and they got, I don't know, animals, and they live close to family. And I obviously told him how amazing he is. And I'm grateful every day to him. He's got some good cells.
He has. He's done amazingly well.
Yes, he has. Okay. And he's apparently him and his wife, but she was his girlfriend at the time, were going through the mall, and there was some kind of stand. I don't know if it was... blood cancer stand or something, or Anthony Nolan maybe, and they signed up there and then.
Okay.
And then obviously, I think it was about 10 years later, he was asked, you know, do you still want to donate? And he said yes.
Wow.
And I think he was a 9 out of 10 match.
Okay.
So yes, I'm grateful to him every day.
Brilliant.
And I'm also grateful to you.
Well, small part, okay.
No, but it's the small parts that count, because you came in to me, you spent 5, maybe 10 minutes a day with me, which to you is probably nothing, but to me, it made my whole day.
Yeah.
Calling me a Kiwi.
Yeah.
That was really lovely, because I was referring to myself as a potato. Mm. And then as soon as you said kiwi and I thought about the little fluffy bits on a kiwi, it just made me laugh.
And we managed to do some sort of more human things, didn't we? Like, we got your daughter to come up and sit outside and stuff when you're a bit more well. Yes, because
you said to me that I could go and sit outside, which I'm not sure the boss
completely agreed, but, you know, what's the risk?
What is the risk? I mean, I didn't go near anybody and I wore a mask and I just went and sat outside in the sunshine. Yeah. Oh, and it was... It made the world of difference, you telling me that I could do that.
I think we, as medics and nurses, if you get so sort of ingrained in this institutional groupthink that like doing things like that is risky, when actually, yeah, it might be slightly risky because you could fall down the stairs, but the benefit... Yeah. The benefit to just feeling the sun on your face and being outside is immense, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And, you know, the QE ward, for example, is miles away from outside, so it's difficult.
When I was discharged, well, actually, as you probably know, I discharged myself after my transplant.
Because, near the end.
I've been in there a month and I had my transplant on the 6th of October, nearly 3 years ago. And I discharged myself, I think it was about the 25th of October, and my bloods weren't coming up. And they'd already told me that when my neutrophils reached a certain level, they would discharge me. And that level still meant that I was neutropenic. It still meant that I was very vulnerable.
Yeah.
In my eyes... What difference does it make if I'm that much neutropenic or that much neutropenic? And I knew my daughter had bleached our flat to within an inch of its life. And there was only going to be me and my daughter in there. Yeah. So in my thinking, if I stay in hospital another day, I am literally going to lose my mind.
Yeah.
I was crying every day. Yeah. The doctor tried to talk me out of it. He tried to get my daughter to talk me out of it. I had to sign a disclaimer. Yeah. I got everybody panicking. And it was the best decision for me.
Yeah. It's all about balance.
And you know me. I know what's good for me.
Yeah.
And it did turn out to be the right decision for me.
Yeah.
So when I was picked up and I went outside, because it was October, it was dark. And it was raining, and it was such a lovely feeling to go outside and feel the rain.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Brilliant. I think we'll leave it there. I guess when I say leave it there, I want to ask you one more thing. If you could change or tell medics or nurses one or two things, I mean, you've already said a lot of things, what would it be like, the main thing that we should do differently?
Not to tell a patient they're going to die at every appointment. Maybe plan at whatever stage to tell somebody, because you only need to tell somebody once. To listen to the patient, because some patients genuinely do know their own body. So when I was telling them, you know, I feel sick, try something else. Try something different. Maybe a little bit more awareness and sympathy of what somebody's going through and the effect this is going to have on them. Be careful what you say to family and friends as well.
Yeah. There's so many learning points in that. One of my favourite from that was how much of a difference the inverted commas little people can make. Yeah, you talk about the student nurses who shaved your head and the cleaner who said, I'll get you some barrier cream.
Yeah.
And I guess me, being a trainee and, you know, making that difference, that's really key. And I think even for students, you know, as a medical student, you feel so useless all the time. But actually, you can make a massive difference.
Yeah. And the girl who shaved my head was only very young. She was I don't know, 21. And when she'd shaved my head... Apparently, one of the other nurses told me that she was really upset.
Yeah.
So I wrote her a note, and she cried when she read that as well, apparently. But, you know, that stuck with me, that she did that for me. And I think she was really, really nervous about that. But another nurse sat in front of me and talked to me while I was having it shaved off. And don't underestimate the small things you do.
Yeah.
You know. Bringing me bananas. I'm not saying that doctors should. Another nurse, actually, because the oatcakes in Stoke are really popular. It's a Stoke thing. One of the nurses bought me some oatcakes in. You know, I'm not saying that nurses and doctors should be buying things out of their own pocket. Yeah. I'm not saying that, but it's the little acts of kindness that mean such a lot. And it's what I remember.
Yeah.
That's the thing I remember most.
Yeah, and it brightens your day.
One more thing I'll say, because I know you want to wrap this up.
That's okay.
But one more thing I'll say is, when doctors were coming in to me, they were saying, we'll do this, or we'll change this, or we'll prescribe this. But then they weren't, and they didn't. And I'd ask the nurses, the doctor said this, can you, you know, because I was in such distress and my symptoms were so bad. When the doctor said, oh, we'll change that, or we'll do that, I was hanging on that because I thought maybe that will make me feel better. But then they weren't doing it, they weren't actioning it. And that used to frustrate me.
Yeah.
That was used to make me really angry, and I did shout at one of the doctors and tell him, you know, he came in and he asked me how I was, and I said, well, do you really want to know? Because you're not listening to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Not everybody knows their own body, but I do.
Yeah.
And, you know.
One final question. Because obviously anyone who goes through all that crap is going to have psychological scarring as well. Mm. Have you been offered any like counselling, or does that come with a package? I don't really know.
Do you know what? I was offered counselling while I was in the QE. They never came. They didn't come in.
Okay.
And then after I was in ICU, I can't fault my treatment in ICU at all, but I had no follow-up at all, nothing. I couldn't walk or stand up or anything after I came out of ICU. I had no follow-up, no phone call, no check-in, nothing, no offer of anything. And actually, being in ICU does really have a massive effect. And I did get PTSD.
Yeah.
But I sourced my own treatment for that. I had light therapy treatment, did work. But even the beginning of this year, I took a bit of a dip and I got depressed and I was off work for 4.5 weeks. And I was really, really bad, really crying, really upset, really, really poorly. And I did speak to the nurse at the QE and she said, that's completely normal at this stage, but I'm over it now.
Okay.
I still have flashbacks. I'll be driving somewhere, listening to the radio, singing, and then all of a sudden, I have this thought, you've had leukemia? What the hell? And things like that come into my head, and I have flashbacks of the nightmares I used to have. Just randomly. I could be at work, really busy, really focusing, really concentrating, and have flashbacks. But I suppose it's just one of those things. It's not something that needs treating, but it has a huge effect on the rest of your life.
Has the whole thing changed how you live? Do you go on holiday more? Do you do more? Do you work less? Do you put...
All of the above.
Yeah.
I haven't been on holiday for 4 years because I was terrified of catching COVID.
Yeah.
But I'm going on holiday in less than 3 weeks. For the first time, the immunologist has given me antibiotics to take just in case I pick anything up. So that's really good. And she's told me to wear an FFP2 mask in the airport, which I'll do. I cut my hours from 37 to 30, which is really good because it means that I don't work on a Friday, and I don't think I could work on a Friday. I look after myself really, really well, better than anybody I know. I always plan in rest. So if I'm doing something, I'll think about all the things I'm doing and whether I need to rest in between. I'm really good to myself. I'm really kind to myself and I really look after myself. And doing all of that means that I can work, rest and play.
With that, we'll leave it there. You've done so well. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Don't Just Read the Guidelines is for education and entertainment only and should not be taken as medical advice. I certainly cannot guarantee the factual accuracy of any of the content, but if you do have any constructive criticism, please find me on Twitter, at Richard Booker. If you like the show, please take the time to write a review on iTunes, Google, or wherever else you listen. It will really help others find the podcast. See you soon.